From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Tyler Scott, in for April Bear. Today, former Governor Rick Snyder's pretrial begins in the ongoing legal battle over the Flint water crisis.
This is taking much longer than normal, but as we know about the Flint water crisis, this is not a normal case.
And we'll check in on the Independent Redistricting Commission.
People can watch what this commission is doing. Nothing is happening behind closed doors. These lines will be drawn in open meetings.
Then a conversation with a former head coach of the Detroit Pistons about race and politics in the NBA. Plus, how do you like your cicadas?
So we got a recipe for pizza, and then somebody came over with a recipe for ice cream. And then other than that, we kind of just copied shrimp recipes because we heard that was the closest analog.
Cicada cookouts. Yep, it's a thing. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Tyler Scott, filling in today for April Bear. Later on the program, we'll get an update on how things are going with the Independent Redistricting Commission here in Michigan. But first, former Governor Rick Snyder's pretrial begins today regarding his culpability in the fallout over the Flint water crisis. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody's been following this story for several years now, and now heads back into the courtroom. Steve joins us here on Stateside. Thanks for being here, Steve.
I'm very glad to be here.
So remind us a bit about the allegations levied against former Republican Governor Snyder.
Rick Snyder is facing two counts of willful neglect of duty related to his actions during the Flint water crisis. He's one of nine government officials who were charged back in January. And at this point in the criminal process, we're in what's called discovery, which is where the prosecution and the defense share their evidence. And at this point, the defense is not happy with what it's getting back from the prosecution. And that was the subject of today's very brief pretrial hearing.
Has Snyder said anything himself publicly or in court about the allegations against him?
At this point, what the governor has said is essentially not guilty. He has pled not guilty to these two charges. And we're still at the point of trying to figure out exactly what the charges are about. This was the result of the actions of a one-man grand jury, a judge in Genesee County who reviewed the evidence presented to him from the attorney general's office, and he delivered the indictments. And it's just taking a long time for the process to vet all of this information that was before the judge, and that has been very frustrating for the defense attorneys waiting to get all that information.
How unusual is this, Steve? You mentioned the one-man grand jury. The defense doesn't even know the witnesses. Is this typical?
It definitely is not typical, starting with the one-man grand jury. That's not a normal process, right, though it's not that unusual. I think this has been complicated by a number of different things, including the pandemic. That's affected all kinds of criminal cases all across the state. And the volume of information that's involved in this case is much larger than you would normally see in a misdemeanor case. So this is taking much longer than normal, but as we know about the Flint water crisis, this is not a normal case.
So does it look like the defense, though, might get what they want in terms of access to more documents and more information about the evidence behind the allegations against Snyder?
I would say that, you know, they will get the evidence that they want. Eventually, the thing that is bothering the defense more than anything else is the pace that this is taking. It is taking a very long time for this evidence to be vetted and delivered to them. And so that's going to lengthen the amount of time it's going to take before this case can move forward in the normal process.
And do you have an idea of how long to expect this phase to last before the trial gets started?
Honestly, I don't think anyone has an idea how long this process will take. Again, there are a lot of different factors here that are unusual, and that's just contributing to the length of time that this is taking place. So it's going to be quite a while. I can't give you a time specific as to when the next phase of this process will begin because it's just such an unusual case at an unusual time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. How much are people in and around Flint paying attention to Snyder's case? Have you talked to people who are emotionally invested in seeing how the outcome of this trial, how it plays out?
When these charges were first announced in January, there was a great expression of, you know, finally it's about time, and also, you know, a misdemeanor charge is not enough. But there is overall just a general frustration that we are now 7+ years since Flint's water was switched and the crisis began, and the fact that, you know, we have not had a prosecution of anyone in, you know, anyone in this case. No one has done jail time. And at this point, you know, there is no expectation that we're going to see anything happen, maybe for another year or two, depending on how long it takes for this process to move forward. The frustration with, you know, waiting for justice, that's just an undercurrent in this city and has been for quite a few years.
Former Governor Rick Snyder had a pretrial hearing today. We've been talking with Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody, who's been following that story for several years and will continue to. Brood X, the celebrity cicadas emerging after 17 years of solitude underground in parts of the United States, have been frolicking in abundance north of Ann Arbor. The excitement around the big bugs has led to all kinds of selfies, conversations, works of art, and food. So what's the best way to cook up a cicada? Ypsilanti resident Anthony Johansson did the research and hosted a cicada barbecue this weekend. Anthony, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Totally. So I think the first question is, why did you want to cook up some cicadas and eat them? You see these creepy bugs out. What made you turn that into a meal?
Well, it sort of comes from an interest in foraging. I'm already out in the woods looking for mushrooms and things. The idea of food that appears for free out of the ground just really interests me. And yeah, I heard there's going to be so many cicadas that it's making the news. I figured this seems like a great time to go and try and eat some.
Yeah, so I'm in Ann Arbor, and I haven't seen a single cicada or heard one yet, but I'm not out in the forest looking for them. Where are you at, and, you know, how are you covered in cicadas? How populous are they where you're at?
So, doing landscaping, I'm around all over Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, but so far it's been closer to the river, or if you go out to Cherry Hill Nature Preserve, they are thick there.
So once you decided that you were going to turn them into a meal, how did you figure out how you were going to prepare them and cook them up?
So that was sort of a group project, but my wife has gotten a couple of insect cookbooks off of the internet in the last few months, kind of getting ready for this idea of eating bugs. So we got a recipe for pizza out of there, and then somebody came over with a recipe for ice cream. And then other than that, we kind of just copied shrimp recipes because we heard that was the closest analog to something we knew how to cook.
So the ice cream, I mean, do you just dump a bunch of dead bugs into a big vat of vanilla ice cream? How's that work?
No, this was actually all the way homemade. I believe it started with butter and cicadas ground up, turned into a base, and then homemade ice cream made with that.
Whoa.
There were waffle cones with ground up cicadas made specially for it. And then a candied cicada caramel coating.
My man, before I ask you how they taste, did you ever think maybe I'm taking this a little too far?
I mean, the thought crossed our minds, but once we started going, it seemed like there wasn't any going back. We might as well cook everything we could think of because, you know, it's going to be another 17 years, I guess, until we get the chance.
So you said it was a group effort. It was you and your wife. Who else do you have involved? It strikes me that giving kids a chance to eat cicada ice cream would be worth doing it just for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my neighbors next door to me where I live at the trailer park came over, and their daughter was there. She's probably the most, I don't want to say that, she eats bugs, like, all the time. So it's it was fun to get her. She actually, I think, is the only one who ate a whole unprepared, let's say. It was cooked, but it wasn't put into a jalapeno popper or deep fried. It was just a baked cicada, and she was ready to chomp those down.
The pan-seared salt and pepper, nothing else on it approach.
Yeah.
Yikes. So how do they taste?
They kind of blend into most food, but yeah. I think the ice cream is where you can kind of get the most of it, and it's sort of nutty is what the consensus was. Baked, they kind of come off like a fried potato.
Really? I would not have guessed you were going to say fried potato.
Yeah, but then there's also the eyes don't change when they cook, so they're always looking at you, and there's the wings. We didn't find a good way to remove the wings, and that's the one downside for me is I got one sort of stuck in my throat, and that ruined the night for me. But
oh man, I got to ask too. Your wife made cicada poppers, like jalapeno poppers. Like you're telling me, you injected bugs with cream cheese or something?
Well, no, we put cicadas and cream cheese inside of jalapenos.
Okay, that actually texturally, you kind of got something going there.
Yeah, that one worked out pretty well. We had one incident where somebody bit one of those poppers in half and a couple of juicy cicadas came out, and that was fun to look at. There was a lot of gross outs, but, you know, in the end it was okay. I don't think I'm going to make it a habit, I guess, of eating great big winged bugs.
Fair enough. Anthony, there's also, you know, this phenomenon with the cicadas where they get this fungus on them, or I guess infecting them from their time in the ground, and it makes their butts fall off. I'm not making this up. This is well documented. Was that something you had to deal with and make sure you were staying safe?
Yes, definitely. As we were out harvesting, we came across quite a few of the cicadas with no butts and a funny white bump instead. And looking that up, it turns out it's a pretty aggressive fungus, but from the tiny bit of research we could find, it didn't seem like it was dangerous to people, but we still passed on eating those ones.
So you were sorting them out like the squirrels and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Good cicada, no butt, bad cicada, throw it out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hilarious. If you had to suggest a drink pairing for the bugs, what would you know, beer, wine, soda pop, what were you drinking?
I mean, to be honest, it was several beers is what got us to the point of eating the cicadas. But once you overcome that initial fear, I'd say it's really up to whatever dish you're preparing, because they seem to go into just about anything.
Sure. Yeah, I'd need a little liquid courage to try it myself, probably.
Just a little bit.
So in 17 years, when Brood X pops through the neighborhood again, you're going to be hosting another cicada barbecue?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Anthony Johansson, thanks, man, for making some time and chatting. And better you than me, I think, my friend.
Well, yeah, that's been fun.
Coming up, we'll talk to former Detroit Pistons head coach Ray Scott. He's working on a memoir that shares his thoughts on how the NBA has been a platform for socially conscious black players. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Tyler Scott, in for April Bear. Imagine hopping off a subway in New York, picking up a newspaper because it's a time before cell phones, and flipping it open to find out you've been drafted by the Detroit Pistons. That's how Ray Scott got the news when he was drafted fourth overall in 1961. Later, he became the Pistons' head coach, and in 1974, he became the first black NBA coach to win Coach of the Year. Now he's writing his memoir, reflecting on how the NBA has been a platform for black players to influence culture, including through activism and philanthropy. Ray Scott, thanks for joining us on Stateside.
Well, thank you, Tyler, for having me, and thank you for that wonderful introduction.
And I also got to say, because others will ask, we are not related. I've never even dunked.
And I have only walked across Michigan's campus, so yes.
Fair enough. So when you started writing, you were really interested in writing about the NBA as an institution. What story were you trying to tell?
What I was trying to do, Tyler, and what I am attempting to do, and I hope it sells, is I was, you know, we live in a parallel universe. There's the universe that we ourselves live in, exist in, and so forth. And then there's the world around us. And what I am trying to get out to fans that may be interested is that universe that I come from in terms of civil rights, in terms of the 1960s with John Fitzgerald Kennedy and his New Frontiers promotion, but also overriding a little bit what occurred in the 1950s with respect to Emmett Till in 1955, which really, for me as a 16-year-old, kind of started my interest in civil rights and what we could do. not just as a person, but as a people. And so I became interested and I started looking at documents and so forth and keeping up daily, because we had at that time in Black America, or at that time Negro America, we had two magazines. We had a monthly magazine called Ebony and a weekly magazine called Jet. And so they proceeded to give us illustrations of the dastardly deed that was done to this young man and how it played out in the justice system. So that's when we knew that in the North, and in North, when you're a Black in the North, you're more protected by the rules and governance of society than much more so than in the South. So from that perspective of looking at things in the North, we wanted to get involved and be included in the March for Justice with the outcry. And John Fitzgerald Kennedy came forth in 60 when he ran for the president of the United States and said, we want to include our Negro population and not have it excluded. And we are going to have new frontiers. Well, that resonated with me because two things were going on. One, I was playing basketball. And two, I was becoming aware after coming home from college and so forth as to something that I could do, something we could organize and do. And little did I know that my platform would become the NBA. Because I was drafted in 1961, and I was told that I would be drafted. I didn't believe it, but I was drafted number four in the country, as you indicated. But it just gave me a broader perspective, because now, as a kid from South Philly who went to school in Oregon, now I'm in the Middle West. And in the Midwest, things were really starting to happen in cities like Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland, the larger urban areas. So it really gave me the impetus to reach out and touch and read and study and from the perspective of everyday living while existing in this vacuum called the NBA.
Right, right, right. So you're a guy who's very plugged into what was going on with the civil rights movement in real time as you're playing basketball. How did you get involved playing ball, though? When did you start, and when did you realize there was a possibility you could make a career out of it?
Well, I started because my father died when I was 8 years old, and I became a latchkey kid to my little brother and I, because my mom then had to go to work. And they had a little crusty basketball court on the second floor, which is only about almost just a little bit bigger than a closet or a kitchen. But I just fell in love with looking at the baskets and listening to the sounds and playing basketball. So I was about 8 and 10 years old. I think I played my first game and I was petrified, of course. And then it went on from there to where you just grew up, and I was growing into a very tall child. I think I was 6'6" when I was in the 10th grade. And so I just started playing and playing. But in those days, Tyler, because of segregation, you know, basketball was not something you thought you were going to do as a career. It's not like today. Back in the 40s and 50s, there was no identification with the African-American community in basketball whatsoever. But I must add, there was the Harlem Globetrotters. Sure. And so when we looked at basketball, we looked at it from the perspective of entertainment and the Globetrotters. We didn't look upon it as a profession. In 1950, when the NBA drafted and signed African-American players, then we began to get a vision of ourselves, because I come from an era in America where the last thing you would see in any advertisement or in any information, any infomercial would be African-Americans. We were not considered part of society in the marketing aspect of things at that time. So we very rarely saw ourselves. So it took a while. And I went through high school, played basketball in high school, became an all-city player, went to college. I was an honorable mention All-American in my sophomore year, dropped out of school, played in the Eastern Basketball League. And I'm one of the few guys that was ever drafted from an amateur league into the NBA. I was not drafted out of college,
right.
Although they give my college title, University of Portland. I was actually drafted out of the Eastern Basketball League.
Wow. Wow. So yeah. When you were a player and a coach, as a guy who's, you know, socially conscious, paying attention to what's going on, what were the kind of conversations you were having with guys in the locker room, your fellow players and later your teammates as a coach? And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier the kind of dual lives we live, the conversations yes. you felt like you could have in the locker room and the limitations on how you could talk about that in public.
Yeah, you know, conversations in locker rooms are really overrated because everyone thinks that it's this great inner sanctum of philosophical agreements or disagreements and so forth. Actually, your best conversations with your teammates, I think they come on planes, buses, as I recall, over beers, you know, and we would wax poetic on Dr. King or Malcolm X or the Black Panthers or the Weathermen or Vietnam, what was coming with Vietnam and the draft and so forth, because all of those things were part of our lives.
So today, you know, I think of, especially in recent memory, since, you know, Ferguson, Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, George Floyd, name after name after name, protests mm-hmm. against police brutality and racism have been openly embraced by players both in the NBA and WNBA. What do you think about these days when you see more players talk openly and publicly about what's going on outside of basketball?
Great question. I've never been more proud of the NBA in my life because of what we discussed back, like the question you asked earlier, back in the day, mm-hmm. to have grown to a league to where there's not only activism, but awareness of the names of the people, not backing off of the Black Lives Matter saying, we're saying Black Lives Matter. We're not saying no one else has the same feelings about Black Lives Matter, but we're not making it political. This is not a political statement. This is a statement about a people. And if you care to go back in the 400-year history of our country or the 250-year history of our government, then you would understand what has transpired. And those are the conversations that we need to begin having. Well, I think the NBA, in my opinion, is leading the country in those discussions and bringing them about. And I think that the experiment that we have with democracy for the last 250 years, I still think we're at the point of where we could be a wonderful, great country, diverse country, which is supposedly the intent. But we have to really look at the reality of what our stories are and what we intend to have for each other, not give, but what we want to have, because when one has, then we all have the ability to share. When one gives, that means you are in possession of it, and I only get what you want to give me. And I pray for the day that we are a have country, where we have equality, we have equity, we have financial stability. I pray for those things, Tyler.
Sure. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Ray Scott. He's the former head coach of the Detroit Pistons and has a new memoir coming out next fall. Ray, you're calling your book The NBA in Black and White. How'd you land on that title?
Well, actually, the original title was Walking with Giants, A View from 6'9". And it was too long. They said, that's too long. And so I said, well, this was my thinking because I was going to give my view and share it with those who would be interested. And so the publisher and my co-author said, "Nah, we want a little a different title." And so that's how Chaz came up with the NBA in black and white, because that really is a parallel universe that we were speaking of earlier. But the NBA, in my opinion, is miles ahead of the other professional leagues in our country. And I didn't even know until last week, Tyler, when they named Monty Williams of the Phoenix Suns Coach of the Year. He was actually in over 50 years, he was the 10th African-American coach named in our league.
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about that. There's a little bit, I totally hear what you're saying in terms of being proud of the NBA sort of making space for its players to take public social positions. But yeah, yes. I mean, since you were the first guy in 76, excuse me, Coach of the Year, only 9 other black coaches have been named Coach of the Year. You've got other stuff going on, like, you know, the NBA is kind of tiptoed around some political issues in China at the risk of losing the audience there. But you still have a lot of admiration for the NBA despite these shortcomings. Why is that?
And, you know, that's a great point. The shortcomings are going to be there because we're human and we're going to make mistakes, and things where we should be aggressive, we probably will not be. And things where we shouldn't be as aggressive, we may go into. But it's in my opinion, you still have to take the step. And what I see the NBA doing is bringing people to the table, which is not what we've done in America. See, those are the lessons that I'm talking about. With respect to the NBA, we have, I think, saturated the market with NBA leadership, with in terms of general managers, in terms of presidents of the team, in terms of players, coaches of the year, all-stars. I think we've done a great job in the NBA. I wish the country moved the same way and we could invite people to the table in Washington, D.C. Now, I don't disagree that we have things that we failed in. I agree with you. I wish we'd handled the situation differently in China, because if the Chinese players, and I'm only relating to the players, but if they don't feel the same freedom that I feel as an NBA player, ex-player, and so forth, if they don't feel that, then none of us are really free. We still have to fight. And I'm not real big on the shoe industry and what they did with cost of the shoe versus the payment to make the shoe.
Sure.
So there are issues. I would never represent to you that the NBA does not have issues. I think we do.
Totally.
But at least we can be active enough to discuss them and see if there are some ways that we can resolve and build on these things.
What you're saying is the NBA has been successful of doing is creating the publicity around the players being able to advocate for social causes, something you weren't able to do when you were a player or coach. What caused that change, do you think?
I think Oscar Robertson's leadership, not only as a ball player, but as a leader of our union. When we unionized in 1960 and we were certified in 1970, that led to great change in the NBA.
Okay. Giving players more input in how the business was done?
Right. It was the NBA Players Association, and we were brought, that's what I was discussing earlier about being brought to the table.
Gotcha.
We were brought to the table by the NBA owners.
Gotcha. And a lot of people who are fans of sports, basketball fans, others, desperately wish that sports could be a total escape from the reality of politics and current events. You know, they want to keep their sports and their entertainment separate from the news. Surely you've heard that. What do you say in response to people who say that?
that you're being ridiculous, and you're showing that you still have a piece of supremacy and racism within your spirit. You, because it's predominantly African Americans, and you're telling us to shut up and dribble.
Right.
That you're telling me that I'm good enough to entertain you. I'm even good enough to be paid by you, but I have no right to opinions. I have no right to standing. And I'm sorry, my friends who feel that way. But like I said, since the 1950s, we've been fighting for these standards, and we will continue to fight.
Ray Scott is a former Detroit Pistons head coach, 1974 Coach of the Year. Before that, power forward and center for the Pistons from 1961 to 1967. Also coached at Eastern Michigan University in the 70s. He's publishing a book, memoir, next fall, titled The NBA in Black and White. Ray, thanks for talking to us, sir.
Thank you, Tyler. Thank you so much.
Time for a quick break. When we get back, the state's Independent Redistricting Commission is looking to the public for input on how to draw district lines. We'll check in on how that's going.
This is meant to be a process for the first time in the history of Michigan where every citizen can get involved. Any resident of Michigan can give public comment to this commission.
This is Stateside. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm Tyler Scott in for April Bear. The Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission is going to be something to pay attention to all summer. The commission's in charge of drawing new maps for Michigan's political districts, but first is the matter of getting public input. This week, there are two public hearings in Detroit, including one tonight, where anyone can attend and tune in to submit public comments. Today, we wanted to check in with Sue Hammersmith, the commission's executive director, about what people have been saying so far and what the rest of the summer looks like. Sue, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Tyler. I'm so happy to be here today.
We're glad to have you. So Michigan Radio recently reported the 211 hotline in the state added a way to give feedback to the commission just by calling 211, partly because the commission wasn't getting as many comments from the public as it had hoped. The commission had a goal of getting 10,000 public comments. How's that going?
Well, we're not halfway to our goal, but there's still time for people to comment. The 211 hotline was added to help address the digital divide. Not everybody has a computer or has internet access. So this provides a means where anyone with a phone can call in and provide their public comment.
The commission's been doing these in-person public hearings that you can also watch virtually since early last month. What's the point of the public comments? What impact can people have when they tell the commission what they want to see?
Well, first of all, the public hearings are mandated in our Constitution. Our Constitution says that we shall conduct at least 10. Our commission is, I call them overachievers, because they're conducting 16 public hearings throughout the state to gather input from the citizens of Michigan. This is meant to be a process for the first time in the history of Michigan where every citizen can get involved. Any resident of Michigan can give public comment to this commission about how they would like to be represented in our state Senate, our state House, and our Michigan delegation to Congress.
And just as a quick matter of public service, what are the ways people can submit comments and even map proposals to the commission?
Well, we would love to have them show up to any one of our public hearings. Tonight, we will be at the Village Dome at Fellowship Chapel in Detroit. And on Thursday, we'll be at the TCF Center in Detroit. Next week, we'll be in Port Huron at the Blue Water Convention Center on Tuesday and at the MRCC Banquet Center in Warren on Thursday. And the last week of public hearings, June 29th, will be at the Van Dyke Mortgage Center in Muskegon and DeVos Place on Thursday in Grand Rapids. All these start at 5. People can enter at 4 and start signing up to give in-person public comment. And if they can't join us, we welcome them to give virtual comment, but we do ask for those signups by noon on the day of the public hearing for which they'd like to give a public comment, because that gives staff time to contact people and get them connected through the Zoom meeting where they can give their virtual comment.
Sue, you've been sitting through the meetings with all the commissioners. I don't know how much you want to talk about this specifically, but just in terms of general themes, what are you hearing from people in terms of how they want their political maps to look like?
We are hearing comments about people that feel they should be in different districts than they are, or that they want to keep the same districts that they're in. But we're hearing also a lot about fairness. Please be fair. Create competitive districts. Don't divide our city into five parts. So there are many, many constructive comments that we're hearing from people about the district that they would like to live in and vote in. We just encourage people to share with us, because these commissioners, while they're from all over the state, certainly don't know every nook and cranny in our state. And we want to be informed so the commission has a good sense of what is important to the people in our state and how they can help our state be better.
You guys are gathering, the commission is, a lot of information in this public feedback process. Once you have all these submitted comments and in-person comments, what do you do with them then?
Well, all that goes to people with the technical expertise to draw the maps. So they will be receiving a multitude of data from the public hearings and other sources of data that will be used to begin to draw the maps after these public hearings are over. At the present time, we're not allowed to draw a single line until the public hearings are over.
Last question. The commission was created as a backlash to partisan gerrymandering. What are the goals the commission wants to achieve in terms of what makes a good map from the commission's view?
A fair map that will allow people to have an opportunity to vote for candidates of their choice. We have several critical success factors that are built right into our strategic plan. And the first is diverse input from people across the state that they can participate meaningfully in the process. We're going to always uphold the Constitution. All actions will be undertaken with a commitment to fairness, with a commitment to nonpartisanship, and in open meetings so people can watch what this commission is doing. Nothing is happening behind closed doors. These lines will be drawn in open meetings, and the public can participate in the process. So if they see the commission missing their community of interest, they can give us more public comment and let us know, hey, you know, that line should be around this neighborhood, so we include these people also.
Sue Hammersmith is Executive Director for the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Sue, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tyler. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Sergio Martinez Beltran covers the state capitol for Bridge, Michigan, and he's been tuning into the public hearings where commissioners want to hear from members of the public about what they want to see when the new district lines get drawn. Sergio, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. What's the point of these public meetings? What kind of information is the commission looking to hear from the public?
Yeah, you know, so for the last 5 weeks, the commission has been touring the state, and their main goal is to hear from communities of interest. And that's the broad term that, you know, pretty much means our communities that share economic values or historical values or cultural values. And their goal is to hear from them and then take that feedback and use it for when they start redrawing the state's congressional and legislative maps.
What have you been hearing? You've tuned into hours and hours of these public hearings so far. What are the themes that you're noticing when people are giving public comments about how they want the maps drawn?
Yes, they have a lot of feedback, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how the commission ends up taking all of this information. I mean, we've heard from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people from already Marquette, Gaylord, Lansing, and other areas in the state. And, you know, there are some things that we found very interesting as we've been listening to these meetings. One of them is this idea of the commission using school districts as building blocks of the new maps. Many people consider their school district area as the area where they live. So, for example, here in the Lansing area, the Okemos School District, people say they live in Okemos, but that's not a city or a town because it doesn't have a mayor. It's just a school district. So people have talked about using school districts since they feel so close to that. We've also heard from others who have mentioned this idea of keeping religious communities together when the commission draw the new maps. And then I think one of the biggest ones that we've heard, it's the public wants the commission to consider the urban-rural divide. I mean, meaning that they want the commission to understand that those who live in the urban areas versus the rural areas, they might not share a lot of things in common, and they might need to be either split in districts, or they might have to figure a way to make sure those voices are heard.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I covered the first public hearing in Jackson for the Michigan Radio Newsroom, and that exact thing kept coming up, and it's a lot of information for the commission to consider. It's also overlapping and kind of competing interests at times. Like a farmer in a rural area might get up and say, my community of interest is agriculture. I want to be in a all or mostly rural district to represent agricultural interests. Well, someone else from the same rural community, like outside Jackson, might say, I live in a rural spot, but I drive into Lansing or Jackson or Ann Arbor for work, and I want both of those areas where I live and where I work to be represented in the same district. So what are the things that experts you've talked to say are going to be the hardest to sort through? And, you know, does that set of conflicting interests in different people, is that one of the hurdles?
That is. And, you know, I think one of the things that the experts that I've talked to have mentioned to me over and over and over is that regardless how we draw the districts, there are going to be some winners and some losers. What matters here is that the commission has to follow the law, follow the criteria that they have established and they have adopted, and then try to make the district as fair as possible, if that makes sense. So yeah, the urban-rural divide, it's very complicated and it's important, but it's challenging. And it's mostly challenging, you know, because there are some districts that are so big that they cover rural and urban areas. And so that's when those districts end up leading to complaints about equity and fair representation. So at the end of the day, the commission will have to consider this and then try to figure out how to draw districts. The other interesting thing, Tyler, is that when we're talking about the urban and rural divide, people have talked about making sure that people that think like themselves, so let's say Democrats that think like Democrats or Republicans that think like Republicans, that they are all grouped in one same district. That's what experts call packing. And there are some challenges with that, because then that could mean that there is a lot of power from one particular community in one district, but then they don't have any other power in other districts, which means that the community as a whole will not be as powerful, or their voice would not be as loud as if they were to be split among other districts, if that makes sense.
You're saying that some people might kind of instinctively want to be grouped together with what they see as their community of interest, but it actually might not be the best strategy in terms of being equally represented.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that's another thing that we've heard from people in the community. There are specific groups that would like to consolidate power. You know, an example of that group is Bangletown. They really want to consolidate power. They want that community that is growing to have a fair representation and to have someone that they like. And that's one of the communities that they would not like to see, you know, that split into different districts.
Tell us more, because everybody might not be familiar with Bangletown, where that area is, what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's in Hamtramck area. It's a lot of Bangladeshi residents that are here in Michigan. They live there and they have created their own community. They have markets there. They have, you know, a strong sense of community there. It's about 2,000, 3,000 people. So it's not a huge community. But clearly, again, talking to folks there, they have been organizing to ensure that they can go to the meetings and they can lobby for their community, which again we are calling Bangletown, and that's how they call it, can stay together in the same district.
Interesting. Do you think there's a geographic area of the state where how the lines get drawn on the new maps is going to be the most contentious? I think, you know, since Michigan is losing a congressional seat, and just because of population density in Southeast Michigan, that's it's going to shake up things, how the map looks around Detroit, Metro Detroit, or no?
Yes, I think it's going to be interesting to see. Like you mentioned, we're losing a seat, and it sounds like it could be the 13th or congressional district, the one that could end up losing a seat based on that population shift. And so it's going to be interesting because there are incumbents there. So the commission, this is important to note, the commission cannot take into consideration the fact that there is an incumbent when drawing the lines. So that's one of the areas, Southeast Michigan, that we are probably going to see some shifting in the redistricting. But then there are other areas in the state, for example, that we can be pretty sure that they're not going to change that much. And that's the first congressional district, which is the one right. that covers the UP and part of the Lower Peninsula. I mean, because of the sparse population, that district, it's likely that it's going to remain the same way.
Yeah, it's a huge district geographically just because there's so few people in the UP. This is a process with the Citizens Independent Redistricting Commission. It's brand new. You know, for many years, political maps got redrawn by politicians, you know, folks whose jobs might actually depend on the outcomes. Now that we're doing it this different way, what's the significance of public engagement, not just as a matter of the commission getting information, things to consider when drawing the maps, but holding these meetings to get feedback in terms of having this be a transparent process that the community can engage with and not just have it be done in the back room under the dark of night in the annals of the state capitol?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. This is a historic moment because people have a more tangible chance to actually create change or at least use their voice to try to influence the process. This panel, they are not politicians. This panel, it's a 13-member group. They are people from all walks of life and from different parts of the state that are not politicians per se. So already they are not as contaminated in a way as politicians have been throughout the last decades when they redraw the maps and they make sure that they are the ones benefiting, their parties are benefiting. And that's why the commission has been asking people to show up. They have been asking people to submit comments either in public when they go to these meetings, but also they can do it online via the website, or they can also do it via Zoom or via the phone. So they have been really trying to gather feedback from people and to reach out to different communities. And I think they're doing it because of two things. First, because they really believe that it's important to do it and it's part of the Constitution. And at the end of the day, this commission came about through a ballot proposal, which meant people really wanted this to happen. But they're also doing it, I think, because since it's the first time, this will set the precedent. And if it goes bad and people start criticizing and complaining that the commission has not been as transparent or as welcoming or open, then this would drag throughout the whole process of drawing maps. So they're really trying to get that out of the way as well, and ensuring that they don't have to confront that. So that's why they're also touring the state and making sure they talk to as many people as possible.
So the commission is made up of four voters affiliated with Republicans, right? Four Democrats and five independents. With a bipartisan makeup like that, does that mean the end result the commission comes up with is going to be immune from being politicized?
100% no. and you know, it's a very political process. So regardless how they work together, there are going to be challenges. I mean, we can expect challenges in terms of how they draw the maps. And when I say challenges, I mean lawsuits. I mean, even before the conception of this commission, there were lawsuits because there were people, there were groups, conservative groups that didn't want this to happen and they didn't want the state to draw the maps this way. So I think that what matters here for the commission, at least, it's that they have to work together and in a way stick together. So that way, when they get challenged, they can have a more bulletproof strategy or a bulletproof form. But no, I think that we can expect those who don't agree with the commission to challenge it. We can expect two communities that are not happy with the way their districts are drawn to also challenge the commission. And, you know, we will have to see what happens at the end of the day. But no, we can expect definitely challenges and political shenanigans in right. this process.
Right. The last time district lines were redrawn, the state legislature was dominated by Republicans. Detroit and Wayne County, of course, vote heavily Democratic. Tonight in Detroit, there's a public hearing of the commission where people can give public comment. You mentioned how the Banglatown community has made their voices heard in this process. I'm wondering, as you watch this event tonight in Detroit, what will you be listening for, knowing that this is the first time that people in this area have really had a chance to have their hands involved in the redistricting?
So tonight and on Thursday, the commission will be holding hearings in Detroit, and they're having 2 days because of how big the area is. What's going to be interesting to hear, again, it's like which communities want to consolidate power, which means which communities want to stick together and stay in the same district, and which communities would like to go to another district. And also, I mean, we know that minorities and other groups have been left out of this process for decades. They have not felt that their voices have been heard. So it's also going to be interesting to see this, again, historical moment where these groups will be able to stand in front of a microphone, in front of the people in charge of drawing the districts, and tell them what they want or what they don't want.
Sergio Martinez Beltran covers the state capitol for Bridge, Michigan, and he's keeping an eye on the public hearings for the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. By the way, like we said, that commission has a public hearing tonight and Thursday night in Detroit. Michiganders can tune in and submit public comments either in person or online. Sergio, thanks for making some time to talk to us, man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's stateside for today. I'm Tyler Scott, in for April Bear. Thank you so much for listening.